Oh, it's already going? All right.
You gotta be aware. It's
already going. Alright, we're gonna have to get started if we wanna get through what I've got. Have you guys checked out the website recently? Okay. We just we got on our LPAC website now all of our science work. So that's pretty awesome. It's all there under animating creativity. You guys should take a look at it later. Okay. So, okay, statistical analysis versus astrophysics and LaRouche's economics. So you're probably wondering what the heck astronomy astrophysics has to do with economics. or maybe why it is that the entire world is collapsing around us. Why is the entire financial system disintegrating? So tonight's discussion is going to aim to figure this out. And also, most of you have already heard that LaRouche is by far the most accurate economic forecaster alive and recorded in history. His record is actually published in the latest edition of EIR, which you guys can all take a copy before leaving. And take a look at the report which was done on all of his forecasts, his 9 forecasts, and what actually happened after he forecasted them. So I'm not going to go through the work that's already been done, because you guys can just take a look at that. What I'm going to get at more tonight is the method. Or in other words, we're going to attempt to understand why he is the most accurate economic forecaster, and how, you know, how is he thinking about economics? What's his method for being the most accurate economic forecaster in history? So. To begin, I'm sorry we don't have the projector now. We're going to have to read all the quotes, but I just printed you them, so it's not going to be too bad. I just need a discount. Sorry about that.
Oh.
You know the best at heart anyway.
Oh, sorry. No, go for it. Okay. For you. Sorry, Berg. Well, actually, how many did I give you there? Did everyone get... Wait a minute. Oh, yeah, those are them. Yeah, right. Alan Greenstein. Okay. So, as a contrast, don't read them all right away. We're going to go through them one by one when it's time for them. But can someone read the first one? Someone with a very high-pitched voice. For fun. Oh, you can? Okay.
The record of forecasting, not only of myself and of companies I have developed, but of the profession as a whole, is not particularly spectacular. I've been forecasting since the early 1950s. I was as bad then as I am now.
Everybody knows Alan Greenspan, right?
Uh-huh.
The ex-chairman of the Federal Reserve. Top a bank in the United States. Right. Okay? So this is what's coming out of the leadership.
There's a nice cartoon of him. EIR.
Oh, yeah? We have an even nicer picture of him, if you'd like.
You sit at the laptop and squeeze all the bubbles.
See his action? Yeah, right. actually, not that.
Yeah. These are really good.
Well, actually, you can just... No, we're not going to go through the picture again. But anyway, he doesn't look too good either. He looks about just as bad as he sounds. Okay. Now, let's contrast that with what LaRouche is saying. You want to read? Yeah.
The point to be made is not that I have been right in these matters, where presumed rival authorities and sundry commentators have been persistently wrong. The crucial point to be considered is the fact that my work has been premised on a correct principle of science, where my putative rivals have relied upon scientifically incompetent premises. The issue thus posed is that of dynamics, as opposed to the incompetence of systems of mechanistic statistical extrapolation, on which the empiricist and the positivist number mechanics rely.
Okay. What does that mean? Right. Dynamics versus mechanical statistical extrapolations. Keep that in mind, okay, as we go through some of this stuff. So let's take a look at LaRouche's latest forecast, the ninth forecast, where he predicted the collapse of the entire financial system in 1994, over 10 years ago. Someone want to read this? Yeah?
In June 1994, LaRouche predicted the collapse of the world monetary system. Quote, the presently existing global financial and monetary system will disintegrate during the new term. The collapse might occur this spring or summer or next autumn. It could come next year. It will almost certainly occur during President William Clinton's first term in office. It will occur soon. That collapse into disintegration is inevitable because it could not be stopped now by anything but the politically improbable decision by the leading government to put the relevant financial and monetary institutions into bankruptcy reorganization.
I love that last phrase.
Yep.
The improbable decision?
The politically improbable decision by the leading government of... And you could replace that whole last thing, truly helping the population. Yeah. The politically improbable decision is someone saying, let's serve the general welfare.
Yes.
Yeah, and really let that sink into your bones, because the part right before that is that the collapse into disintegration is inevitable, because it could not be stopped now by anything but that political decision. And so that says a whole lot about what we have to do. So, okay, well, look, the system is blowing out now, 14 years later. So, why did it take so long? He predicted this in 1994. What's been going on since then? So, let's take a look more closely at what happened since that forecast. The initial blowout during Clinton's administration was held off into his second term in office. There were different schemes, different attempts to try to prevent that collapse. There's a hyperinflationary spiral in rapid derivative expansions, and the beginning of what we know today as the financial system was in place. So there was a complete emphasis or accent or intent focus on financial speculation to try to create a market, to try to find the liquidity, create the liquidity that was lacking. So you did see a blowout that occurred in the late 90s. And this was known as the Asian tiger market collapse, where the economies of Asia were hit pretty hard as a result of a massive increase in Asian currency speculation. So you had a collapse in the Asian markets, which eventually led these speculators to turn to Russia. And there was a massive amount of speculation on Russian government bonds in the late 90s. So,
is this under Yeltsin?
Yeah.
Is this alluding that happened under Yeltsin that the I forget her name now at the conference, this woman developed?
Oh, Rachel?
Rachel?
Yeah.
Is this what you're talking about?
The LTCM blowout?
Yeah. The collapse of the communist system was one part, but in 1997-98, then you had the GKO bond collapse, that's the LTCM.
Yeah, you had a shark attack, vultures that were looking for the next prey, and it happened to be within the Russian bond market, specifically the GKOs. So these hedge funds, one of the hedge funds called Long Term Capital Management, LTCM, is the one that suffered the first blowout. And this was at the time such a huge earthquake that the entire financial system was shaken by this. By this blowout, this bankruptcy. And the Federal Reserve came in to bail them out. This was the first major bailout by the Federal Reserve in its history. It was unprecedented up until that point, which, by the way, is only a hair's breadth, a tiny fraction of the types of bailouts that we're seeing today by the Fed. But at the time, this was enough to have President Clinton come out and say, we need a new financial system. We need a new Bretton Woods.
He said Bretton Woods?
He said we need a new financial architecture.
Yeah, financial architecture.
Yeah. Obviously, we know what happened to him as a result of that. He was taken out pretty quick. You know.
What's he
want? I don't know. It was in the late 90s. Yeah. Yeah, 97. Okay. All right, so 97. All right, their scheme starts to disintegrate. What do? To ensure this inflow of liquidity, patch up this crisis. And this is where you have the explanation of the whole Y2K bubble. Remember that? Where everyone was like, man, you better, buy all kinds of equipment because all our computers are going to crash and, this is going to be like the coming of the end of the world overnight, everything's gonna, and it worked. It was a major market. People bought into this thing like that, and you had an immense amount of spending that occurred all into the pockets of these financiers, of these speculators, really. And
a friend of my mother's went against the advice of his broker and invested in those types of stocks, those high-tech stocks at that time, and he had some money to invest. He had, six digits or something like that, but with $100,000 or a few $100,000, he took out $1 million and then wrote it further till it turned into $4 million or something like that.
Gambling. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, big time.
Either way,
gambling's the name of the game.
It's a zero-sum game, right? Like, there's nothing in the world changed because of his activity to buy those bonds.
Yeah.
And yet he was able to take them out of the box. Interesting.
Whole companies would change their computer. So, okay, 10,000 new computers.
Which is great, but then with the value, well, I mean, good computers are good, but it's just a weird thing that happens to the value of the company, which far outstrips the actual productive aspect, the physical aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah.
Okay. No, sorry. Well, I just. See it was. So, okay.
Y2K.
Yeah, Y2K, IT, it's the same thing, really. It's the same type of idea. The internet, technology, it's just a different bubble. It's the same idea. How do you create a market? How do you create a trend? Make something popular, make everybody want it, and increase the spending so that you can, derive these types of fictitious capital gains on the back of that bubble by using it as a pretext to bundle some new type of fancy named investment deal. Okay. Now this is all around the year 2000. The IT bubble blew out as well, in a similar type of way. And what was brought in was the housing bubble that we see today.
Around
2001 or so, yeah.
Housing bubble?
Yeah. Oh, this is huge. This is where Greenspan comes in. Greenspan, the same dude that spoke at the beginning here. And says, no problem, we're going to lend people as much money as they need. No matter what their ability to repay the loan is, doesn't matter. Because we need to start getting this money in the economy so they could spend and get things flowing again. So, what you have is, where is a situation where just about anybody, income or no income, unemployed or not, really, could get a loan worth an insane amount. you know, you could get a few $100,000 mortgage even if you have, like, no job. And there's all kinds of different conditions that they'll try and set up. They're so desperate, they almost pay you to take the loan, really. You don't have to pay anything for, like, the first 5 years, and then after that, you only pay, like, 5% of the interest, nothing of the principal, for, like, 5 years. And then after that, you know? So it's that insane. But people think it's a good deal. You've got no job, you know, you're a poor welfare...
ex-auto worker.
Yeah, right. You know? You can't even find a job because there are none, and you can get this type of a deal where you can receive a $200,000 mortgage on a house, which may worry you at first because how are you ever going to get the money to repay that? But the thing with the bubble is that the bubble only works if the price of the house always increases. So in your mind, you'll take the deal because next year or the year after, whatever, you can go to the bank and refinance your home for its new value, which should have increased. Now it's worth $300,000. Perfect. Sell it. Pay off your $200,000. Pocket $100,000. Sweet deal. Sounds like it. Sounds like it.
My name is Tambu. I came to this country with nothing. I did not even speak the language. Now look at me.
Yeah.
Nobody got real estate.
That life is beautiful.
I got sucked into that. I was all into it. I was like, man.
It's almost too good to be true.
$1,000 a course.
Okay. So this is the point at which we are right now. And I'm not going to go into the whole, just the whole disease, or what's a good word, the entire parasite of the way the financial system is so, the way that it functions today.
You forgot the last little trick of this nature, the big one. Isn't carbon credit chaining?
Oh, on the rise?
Well, it's
yeah. I mean, at this point, though, I mean, we could, maybe at the end of the, maybe, because I have something, like, more important that I want to get to, but it would be worth, actually, taking a look at how this housing bubble really works, and how it's only used, it's the back of the population which is used to issue different types of package deals. So that's where this whole idea of these fictitious capital gains, because the capital gains are coming in from the bubble that's created off the housing bubble. But we can go through that later, because that may be doing a diagram of that, of how these, you got then the mortgage-backed security, which is issued off the mortgages, and then those that invest in a mortgage-backed security could use that and issue something like a CDO. Those that invest in the CDO can issue the SIV. And then you've got all kinds of these different bubbles that are created. It's like a spiral effect, all off the back of this mortgage bubble. So when you look at that, though, it becomes really clear that no matter what they do, this carbon thing, it may work for a few months, but really, in the end, the entire nature of the financial system is so corrupt beyond belief that it's impossible for it to work more than a few months. How many bubbles can they create? At a certain point, you know, it's over. Okay. Now, so this is where we are right now at the total collapse of the housing bubble, right? Because the prices of houses is dropping. People are trying to get out of their mortgages. So they want to put their house on the market. That decreases the house price even more. and people can't pay because they're stuck with these mortgages that they just can't pay. They were given to people with no money, no jobs, no income. So the banks now have no income, not even on the interest from these mortgages. So how are they supposed to pay back? How are they supposed to pay the interest they owe on the mortgage-backed security they just issued? So they don't. So now, but now the people invested in the mortgage-backed security don't have the interest coming in from that to give back to the CDO that they issued. And those from the CDO don't have the interest that they're supposed to receive from the mortgage-backed security that comes from the mortgages to pay back the SIV that they issued. So this whole thing is now spiraling down, and the people at the top that are watching this unwind at the bottom are going to the bank saying, I want out. I've invested in a derivative, like an insurance, which means that if anything goes bad, I get all my money, so give me all my money, I want out. And the banks are choking now. They're saying, well, holy shit, we don't have all. When everyone comes for their money at once, they don't have the money. You know? So you've got banks that are collapsing right now, that are going bankrupt, totally bankrupt. And the only reason you're not seeing a chain reaction banking collapse is because the Fed is bailing them out. So the population doesn't see it happen.
They feel it, though.
Yeah. Well, they feel everything. Okay, so let's see what LaRouche has to say about this last July 2007. JP?
First of all, this, the war on employment, occurs at a time when the world financial system is actually now in the process of disintegrating. There's nothing mysterious about this. I've talked about it for some time. It's been in progress. It's not abating. What's listed as stock values and market values in the financial market internationally is bunk. These are purely fictitious beliefs. There is no truth in it. The fakery is enormous. There is no possibility of a non-collapse of the present financial system. None. It's finished now. The present financial system cannot continue to exist under any circumstances, under any presidency, under any leadership of nations. Only a fundamental sudden change in the world monetary financial system will prevent a general immediate chain reaction type of collapse. At what speed, we don't know, but it will go on and it will be unstoppable. And the longer it goes on before coming to an end, the worse things will get.
Okay. So that's our situation today. But go back to the forecast. How did he know to make that particular forecast and not some other forecast? Or maybe, you know, maybe along the same lines, but not so intense. I mean, he's pretty straightforward in 94 about what's on the way, you know. He obviously said that knowing that the rest of the world would point and laugh or slander him, call him a kook, he doesn't know what he's talking about. LaRouche, God, don't listen, jeez. You're with LaRouche, oh my God, please.
When did you get it?
95.
Right. Oh, so, yeah, I mean, this is...
He didn't get out in 95. You mean they let him out of prison to make that statement? Or he was allowed to do webcasts from the camp?
Well, you ran for office from the prison.
Wow.
Huh? That wasn't your plan.
Okay, let's keep going. Okay, you know, because really he could have said something similar, just maybe less intense in 94, you know, toned it down a little bit, and maybe people would have listened to him, you know, licked a little ass, and people might have, maybe, you know, but he didn't, he was blunt, you know, about what was on the way. So, right, So, okay, what's up with that, man? He's always doing things like that, you know? He's coming out, he's making these statements that are...
Well, it sounds like he knows.
Uh-huh.
It sounds like he's not, he's not trying to be... Well, I mean, first of all, he's not trying to be popular. He's not catering to public opinion. And furthermore, he sounds like he knows.
Right. Okay. So then,
we
would agree. Yeah. Okay. So then, if we're gonna go with the side that he's not just some arrogant bastard that likes to go around claiming that he knows everything and everyone else is wrong. Okay. If we're going to side with that, maybe he actually does have a certain understanding about economics, which other people are not understand or not getting right now, then how could we develop an understanding of that also? Right? How could we come to understand how it is that he is so confident when he goes out and makes these statements that he could just bam, make them knowing that everyone's going to want to point the gun. And everyone's going to boo and throw tomatoes. And laugh and spit and throw them in jail. Takes a lot of guts, right? But he's got something that he's, you know, that he's understood. That he knows to be true. Okay. All right. Okay. So, just bear with me for the next little while. I don't want to, I don't want to just bombard you with a bunch of... I don't want to overwhelm you with detail. But if you could just stick with it, it's going to be really useful in the end, okay? First of all, how do we begin to understand the process which is unfolding in the world today? You've got so many ways that you can look at it. How do you know how to look at it? Okay? Everything is changing constantly. History is full of, you know, history is so full of all kinds of different events and different stories that happen. Different. How do you know how to look at it? Of all the different things that you can look at, just in the last century alone, to try to have some slight understanding of what's happening today and why it is the entire financial system is collapsing. How do you know what to look at? This, you know. Or you can think of a clear summer's night or winter's night. Winter's cooler because you see a lot more of the ecliptic. But think of the clearest night outside Montreal in the pitch black. And you can see millions and millions of stars. How do you come to know anything about what is ordering things up there? How do you know where to start? So, we've worked a little bit on the new astronomy, some of you guys here, so it's not going to be that much of that confusing for, anyways. You remember how Kepler talks about inequalities? It's one of the first things that he mentions. There are these inequalities. The entire book of the new astronomy is based on investigating those inequalities. So what does that mean? What's an inequality?
that an observation you make doesn't fit your idea of how things work?
Well, no, not so much. But you can think of how you would come to know anything about what's going on in the sky above you. If you're someone that really, really likes to do observations, like me, you can go out every night, and you'll notice, eventually, it won't seem like just a huge blunder of chaos. In fact, you'll find after a while that the sky is pretty small, you know, that you kind of, you know, you're very used to, it's like home, you know, you're very used to where everything is, and, you know, so it's not so chaotic. At that point, you can notice new things, because, you know, one thing, every night, if you go out and observe the stars, and you stay in one spot for a very long period of time, you'll see a rotation in the sky. So, that is a certain series of constellations, primarily, right? Everything rotates around the north, around one point in the sky. But you'll see a series of constellations, the line of the ecliptic, all the, you know, the zodiac signs. Well, those are all, you'll get to see about five or six in a night go by. The rest go by during the day. We can't see them. So once you start to familiarize yourself with these things, you'll notice certain things are appearing and are not following the common motion of all of these other, of the background of stars. Like a good example would be Mars. And Mars is out at this time of year, which is really, really, really fun to watch, because about a month ago, two months ago, she was in Taurus, and now she's in Gemini and moving faster and faster through Gemini. So it's fun, you know, you can go out every night and you see, or if you don't see it for 2 weeks because the sky is not bright and this and that, Mars. Eventually you'll see and, okay. So you notice that there's something that's going on which is not following the regular motion of all the rest of the stars, the background stars. Now, this is what astronomers were interested in. What is that? A little wandering star, little rebellious star that's not following all the rest, huh? You know? And we know now that those were the planets. All the planets do that. But if you develop a real passion for astronomy and you decide to follow that star until it comes back around to the same place, you'll notice that it's a little off. It's not exactly back at that same place. It doesn't do that perfect, perfect circle. So there's an inequality there, which has you question what the underlying axiom was at the time, which was that all orbits were perfect circles. If it was a perfect circle, it would come back to the exact same place. But it doesn't. There's an inequality there. So these inequalities are very intriguing because they present a starting point in all of the chaos that's going on up there. They present a starting point that from which you can begin your investigation into what's going on. There are a few other examples of these inequalities. Mars, from Earth, if you're observing Mars, every 2 years and a few weeks, we'll do what's called retrograde. But what you see empirically is a loop. Mars does this loop in the sky. And you can watch it. It takes about 2 weeks. And it appears to be moving forward, stops, backs up, does a loop, turns around, and keeps going. So here's another example, right? That happens every 2 years and about 2 weeks. But here's the thing. It actually happens every 2 years, 2 weeks, and a little bit. Every 2 years, 2 weeks, a little bit more or less. It's never precise. There's an inequality there, which is intriguing. Okay? So you can start with that. What's going on here? Okay. Now I want to look at some key inflection points over the course of the last century. Everybody remembers the collapse of the system in 1929? No? Well, it's a good thing you're here. This is really, really important because the entire financial system collapsed. You had a major stock market collapse in the United States, and it created a real shift in the design of the global financial system. We previously had our currencies backed by gold, where you can only issue the amount of gold that your country had in its reserves. There's a gold standard system. I'm not going to go through all the details of that or why why the economy collapsed in 1929. That could be another class.
Just one question. At the time of the collapse, the American dollar was off the gold standard at that point?
No.
No, it was still on.
Yeah.
It was still a fixed currency at that point. Okay.
I'm not sure if it was
fixed. It was a fixed currency from, like, say, George Washington to...
Yeah, that needs to be checked in. There was something that happened...
I know some of the speculative stuff was the same.
Yeah, I mean, I'll have to give a class on that next time. But, because there was something that occurred, there was a change that occurred in the United States, which was, I think, being ruined by the Calvin, Coolidge, administration. And the rape of the economy. Extreme British influence in that hand. We'll look at that some other time, okay? So right now what we're dealing with is what I want to look at is the New Deal, right? So but just keep in mind, like, the system blew out in 1929. People recognize it as the Great Depression. Do you remember hearing that? Like, La Grande Depression, you know, it was a huge crisis. And, the important thing is that Roosevelt came in office to deal with the crisis. President Franklin Roosevelt of the United States. And he reorganized the system through various measures that he took to reorganize the bankruptcy of the banks, but he orchestrated just briefly at what we call the Bretton Woods Conference. He orchestrated a conference which established the financial system known as the Bretton Woods financial system. Bretton Woods system. And it was based, this is the important part, it was based off a fixed exchange rate system. So no longer did you have to have a certain amount of gold in your reserve in order to lend an amount of money out, but they moved, it was now a gold reserve system instead of a gold standard system, which is just that you have to have a smaller percentage of gold. So it's a credit. It's the idea of a credit system that your government could issue large amounts of credit for the purpose of building infrastructure at low interest for public infrastructure, and that the U.S. dollar was pegged to gold at a certain fixed amount to gold, the $1, it was like a gold was worth 34, how do you say it, dollars an ounce or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that was the value, it was fixed, and then all the other currencies in the world were pegged to the U.S. dollar. Meaning their currencies didn't fluctuate from year to year, but it stayed the same. Okay, it didn't, you didn't have like the possibility of a currency like, you know, in Africa or in some country or even here to just collapse the next day. Because it was just...
They weren't all at the same rate.
No, they weren't. They were all at... They'd all... This was what the conference was about, assessing the value of these currencies. So what I want to actually look at, though, okay, is this is not that, but it's the idea of the New Deal, the transformation that occurred under the New Deal. That was what Roosevelt used to rebuild the economy after it had been destroyed. And I just want to play something here because this gives a good idea of what that was. Okay, so it's just going to be better than me talking. And sorry, but there's no projector, so you might want to come and sit up closer.
No, it's just quiet.
Can you guys see? I don't know exactly where it is, I just know it's in the beginning. So I'm just going to play it.
Let's put some sound in here.
Oh, yeah, okay. Okay, so they're at the beginning, okay? It's like
in a matter of days, one of the pillars of Wall Street sold to rival J.P. Morgan Chase for just $2 a share.
I want to remind you, this is not the first time since I've been the president that we face economic challenges. And we'll make it through this period, just like we made it through other periods of uncertainty during my presidency.
As you probably know, the world economy is completely collapsed. To the point where even the world's greatest moron would recognize this. What you are probably deeply ignorant of is that in response to this, the city of London, which created the crash, is driving for world fascism. What we will demonstrate to you in this short video is that, like in the crisis of 1932, there is a clear choice today between two options for the U.S. presidential primary. One is the policy of Lyndon LaRouche for a Franklin Roosevelt-like solution. The other, that of his rivals, George Shultz, Felix Roatan, and the city of London, is a policy of launching Eurasian wars and looting the economies of the world. Therefore, you, the American citizen, must stop acting like a jerk, for this is the most important decision you have to make, which will determine human history for hundreds of years to come.
This is not the part I want to focus on.
The world economic collapse of the 1920s and 30s was created by the international gambling houses of the British Empire, such as J.P. Morgan, Brown Brothers Harriman, and Lazard Frères. As the economy collapsed more and more, these bankers, to enforce the continuance of their madness, moved to install dictators in Europe and in the United States. Oh, the fly in the ointment for these plans was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. From his first inaugural address, Roosevelt made it clear that the royal swindlers of London and Wall Street were no longer to be respected in the United States.
Plenty is at our doorstep, but a generous use of it languishes in the very sight of the supply. Primarily, this is because the rulers of the exchange of mankind's goods have failed through their own stubbornness and their own incompetence, have admitted their failure and have abdicated. Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men. Yes, the money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of our civilization. We may now restore that temple to the ancient truth. We must act quickly. And finally, in our progress towards a resumption of work, we require two safeguards against a return of the evils of the old order. There must be a strict supervision of all banking and credit and investment. There must be an end to speculation with other people's money. This nation is asking for action, and action now.
Roosevelt's policy was called the American System of Economics. It included the Emergency Banking Act, which supported vital banking institutions as debt reorganization occurred, the Glass-Steagall Act, which erected a firewall between gambling and saving in the banking system, the Banking Act of 1935, which yoked the Federal Reserve System to federal supervision, the Social Security Act, which provided pensions for 65-year-olds and aid to poor and blind children, and the Federal Farm Bankruptcy Act, which placed a moratorium on farm foreclosures. To secure and build on these protective measures, FDR revived Alexander Hamilton's national bank concept through the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. This federally owned lender financed Roosevelt's Civil and Public Works Administration, Tennessee Valley Authority, and Rural Electrification Administration. These programs employed an average of 3.1 million people each year in building tens of thousands of infrastructure projects. By situating the general welfare principle as the guiding light of the recovery, these measures ripped the destiny of the United States out of the claws of the British Empire. Europe, on the other hand, did not fare so well. The British quickly imposed their two-horned monster, Mussolini and Hitler, on the continent.
My friend!
Oh, follow me!
In Italy, the impotent macho Benito Mussolini was handled by his finance minister and British agent, Volpi di Misurata.
Is that a new movie?
Yeah. Okay. So, that's pretty clear, though, you know?
Yes, what Roosevelt did at the time.
Yeah. And how this changed the relationships of every sector of the economy. How this totally revolutionized the United States. So, okay.
Maybe all the evil people disappeared under the floor again.
Well,
for a while.
Yeah. They're outflanked. Okay, so okay. Okay, so so that was the New Deal. Now, okay, the 50s and 60s after that, right? Because, you know, Roosevelt died in 1945, 1946. So, he didn't get to see, really, the fruits of his system develop every part of the nation, including especially the Third World, like it was supposed to. But the result, I guess, or the product of what he did when he was in power, that did have an impact on the U.S. economy for at least the next decade or two, at least, because of the amount of effort that was put in to this process. However, after his death, throughout the late 40s, 50s, 60s, you saw a process of total vulture grabbing of, at the time it was oil, what they thought would be the next the next gold. And so that whole period of the 50s and 60s, aside from the remnants of Roosevelt's work, is characterized by two things. The major amounts of mergers within the biggest banks of the world coming together to form these huge conglomerate powers, banking powers, banking houses. And the other thing is the rush for oil. These same banks were then going up and grabbing the oil resources and forming what was known as the big six oil companies of American and British oil, financed by these newly merged major banking firm. So that was beginning to emerge pretty well with the death of Roosevelt. And it was that's a significant change to consider, because it demonstrates an intention that was already present before Roosevelt, but that was able to really manifest itself with the removal of the strength of the United States. So, as a result of that process of this financial and political power being concentrated within the banking system that had just taken power, you had a complete neglect of the physical infrastructure of the United States, because the focus was put on making money. So that, okay.
Maybe an interesting parallel might be to consider Montreal's infrastructure, which today is something like 70 years old or something, most of it.
Yeah.
A lot of it. And because I think what Roosevelt did with his New Deal and with the arsenal of democracy and everything he did, I mean, it really did change the world in a large degree. So a lot of the infrastructure that even Canada has today comes from just it's about as far back as those times.
Yeah, right. Right.
And today, all of Montreal spaghetti needs to be replaced. It's all got to be replaced.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's like you can imagine the size of the construction project. It's kind of like not doing your homework for a whole year and then...
Or a whole 30 years.
or it's a bad example, but something physical, like, yeah.
Okay, yeah, right. So you can imagine what this leads to. And in, this is a significant time period to remember. In 1957, there was a major recession in the United States. So think about it. I mean, this is really 1957. Okay. So, look, Roosevelt had really almost just left office. It wasn't that long. It was nearly a decade later. And the economy was collapsing already. Right. So... So you have this economic recession that occurs in the United States, and the cause is not very hard to find. I mean, the financial powers at the time were just not concerned with reinvestment in the physical economy, and they rather than invest in public infrastructure, social systems, healthcare, education, power plants, water generation, different things like that, lend the money to Europe because Europe needed it. Europe was destroyed after the war, and they needed money to rebuild. And so because they needed it so badly, they were willing to pay a very high price, interest. So these bankers, these New York and British bankers, didn't care at all about reinvestment in infrastructure at low interest. They can make a killing off lending to Europe. So that's what they did. Now, just a point on the recession that occurred in the United States. It wasn't completely left up in the air for people to just forget about. There was a circle of people that were brought together to deal with the collapse. And this, for those of you who know the history of this group, called the Council on Foreign Relations, is very closely knit with the British Empire. It's actually a product of the British Empire.
Council
on Foreign Relations. That's the American branch of the Royal Institute for International Affairs.
Oh, yeah.
Remember last year when we did the...
CIA.
That, the CIA is the Canadian branch. The CFR, Council on Foreign Relations, is the American branch. But it's a network of the Royal Institute for International Affairs, which is... it's the round table. Cecil Rhodes and the entire gang of Anglo-Saxon, white race supremacy, British Empire proponents or whatever. Pompous assholes. So that's just no wonder that the economy was not, there wasn't much put into dealing with this recession. Okay, it was the Rockefeller Brothers Fund and the Council on Foreign Relations, which came together to form what they called the U.S. establishment. They were assigned to deal with the economic crisis, the recession in 57. And it's just an interesting note that the chairman at the time of the Council on Foreign Relations was this guy named John McCloy, And he was also the chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank, the bank for big oil. These are the guys that were looting, that were totally looting the economy for profits.
John McLoy.
Yeah. But, okay, anyway, so the point is that they obviously, they didn't deal with the collapse of the economy. They were tightly, they were very closely knit with the financial banking power and the oil cartels that were put into place during the 50s in the United States. So the investment into the skilled labor force, factory production, education, and anything needed to improve the national economy was just disregarded completely. So, now, okay, so here's the thing. Because because of this process of lending massive amounts of money to Europe for reconstruction at ultra high interest, so that was like the premise for these guys, for these bankers. They were just making a killing. But because they were doing that, and because the entire oil trade was done in U.S. dollars, you had an extreme amount, a massive amount of U.S. dollars that were leaving the country, that were leaving the United States. And the important point here is that after a while, Europe was, you know, got itself back on its feet, and it wasn't in such desperate need of reinvesting the money into its economy. So, what do you have, right, when you are just overloaded with U.S. dollars? What are you going to do?
Huh?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, what are you going to do with U.S. dollars, you know? What are you going to sit... Right, right. So, I mean, it's common sense that a machine tool, technology, these types of things are much more useful than a bunch of paper money sitting in the bank. So, that, you know, that was what was happening. Europe began to have a growing rate of U.S. dollars that they were willing to spend and to purchase finished goods with. But because the United States wasn't producing anything, what did they do? Well, give me my gold then. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, if you don't have anything to buy, you've got all this money, and the U.S. isn't producing anything, then you're going to just demand your gold.
On the reserves?
Yeah. It's backed by gold, you know? So what do you do with it? You don't want, what are you going to do with U.S. dollars? You can't buy anything in your economy. And the only thing you can buy in the rest of the world is oil at a certain point, you know? So this is what you had, right? At the same time as a massive amount of dollars fleeing the country, you also have, you know, the entire gold reserve fleeing the country. Because these countries in Europe were demanding gold in exchange for their dollars. But but you know, an extreme amount, well, hold on. Right. Yeah, I mean, yeah, so you could just imagine how, oh yeah, right, that if you've got everybody demanding, or just a significant demand for gold in exchange for these dollars, then you have a high demand internationally for that finite amount of gold. And so
there was a reserve system, it was a credit system or a gold reserve system as opposed to, you said, a gold standard. So that meant there was not actually enough gold to meet every dollar, right?
Yeah. But the point is that because there was such a high demand for gold, the price of gold, the value of gold, went up. In reality, the value was going up. They weren't allowing it to move, though. They were saying it was still $25 an ounce, you know. But the thing is, everybody wanted gold. So the value of gold, when everybody wants something, one thing, that thing is damn valuable. You know? So this is leading to an increase in the price of gold. So if you've got an increase in the value of gold and a decrease in the value of US dollars, then at some point people are starting to realize that there's a flaw, something has to change in this system of fixed exchange. And by 1960s, there was emergency action by Washington and Britain to pool together 10 nations that would supply the gold that was needed to match the value that had risen to a certain value, because the United States could not provide that amount of gold. You had all these nations that came in to back up the U.S. because they knew that if they didn't, this would lead to a collapse of the dollar. So this was called the gold pool, and it was just a 10 nations, Canada was included, that were like pitching in, or they were just providing what was the gap. They're filling the gap. Basically, they're getting screwed.
I don't quite understand.
Well, it's...
So there's this crisis, there's this massive investment in Europe at high percentage. All of a sudden, there's all this American money in Europe. And they want to get rid of their American money, but the American economy had stalled and there was nothing to buy.
Yeah.
And so now they wanted gold. And so as a result of that, it creates a sort of a crisis situation, or at least leading up to the crisis. And so they called together 10 nations to fill the gap. Oh.
To supply the extra amount of gold that the U.S. couldn't supply.
And what would be in the interest of these 9 other nations to do that?
It's in the end, the U.S. was for a long time like Uncle Sam. It was the big guy that you didn't, that you wanted to be on the side of. And a lot of these countries in the early 60s, they bought into, they thought maybe, I don't know, I mean, the U.S. had a bump in the road, let's help them out. They helped, look, the U.S. saved the world from World War II, so.
It sounds more like some type of pressure.
Yeah, pressure.
Interest.
Yeah. But that didn't last too long, though, because this is in the early 60s, and right away you have the Vietnam War, which begins, and the deficit in the United States soared from about $3 billion in the early 60s to about $25 billion in 1967. So you could imagine how this amount of liquidity that created out of nowhere, just printed, to finance the war only added to the further inflation of the dollar, meaning that the dollar, the value of the dollar was inflated way beyond its actual value relative to gold. It was still a dollar per 35 ounce. How do you say that? One US dollar per $35 an ounce? There's a ratio like $35 an ounce of gold. There, sorry. But, so, that was still the value of the US dollar. But because they were just printing money, they were just pumping
money.
Yeah, they were printing money. They were also getting it from...
This is well past creation of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve was printing money.
They were doing that. They were also... it was issued by the government, and they were also using some of the money that they had received from Europe, that they were receiving from Europe.
And what happened to all that interest that was supposedly being earned upon the war?
So that wasn't the government. That was the... Yeah, these banks, they were not, it wasn't a national bank that was issuing money to Europe. It was a private banking system. The whole national banking system that Roosevelt had fought for was completely destroyed after Roosevelt's death. And you had, this is what I was saying beginning, the 50s, you had bank mergers. These guys were just taking things back into their own hands.
Okay, well then there's something that happens between 1945 and this crisis point, or at least in the Vietnam War, that's of an illegal nature, constitutionally, that was passed in Congress or in some other legislative body, to allow what happened to happen. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that Washington, as a political entity, was really in control of their own country. Like, they were really submitting to the will of these New York New York and Wall Street.
Sure. They're facilitating it, even. I mean, with Truman, first of all, and then so on, and so on. But there's something that has to happen there in order to allow the use of national money in that way.
So what time are we talking about?
Early 60s.
Post-45. To the early 60s, to that point. Somewhere in there, there's some bills that are passed. They get pushed through, maybe they're thick documents, maybe no one cares, maybe everybody's like on the same team and wanting to screw the country now that Roosevelt's gone.
Yeah.
But there's something of an illegal nature there in those years that has to occur in order to allow that whole situation to happen. Because under Roosevelt's monetary system, it can't happen.
Well, yeah. I mean, Roosevelt, it wasn't perfect. You know, there were certain...
But the dynamic...
But, yeah,
there is,
see what you're saying.
What we see, what we've seen in the 60s, what you're identifying as an increase of U.S. currency and this increase of the value of gold, and et cetera, et cetera. Like a destabilization of the financial system.
Yeah. Okay, let's keep going. So the Vietnam War, all it really does is add to the further inflation of the value of the dollar, of the U.S. dollar, relative to gold. And as a result of this, there were protestations that were beginning all across Europe asking the United States to devalue, because they knew that they were getting screwed.
Devalue the money?
Yeah. Because at this point, them who had U.S. dollars were getting maybe a certain amount of gold for those U.S. dollars when they should have almost gotten double, something like that. So this was starting to rise, and clearly Washington completely refused obviously under these powerful banking interests to listen to the concerns of these nations in Europe. The only ones that actually did understand that maybe the country should produce its way out of the crisis, like Kennedy, when Kennedy came in with the Apollo project to try to rebuild the economy, they were taken out right away. It wasn't too long. Kennedy was wiped out, shut up, silenced, taken out of the presidency. So there's a clear intention to prevent that from occurring.
Yeah. Every time it happened, right? And then his brother.
Yeah, right.
Was speaking the same way.
Right.
He got killed.
Yeah.
And Martin Luther King too.
Yeah, but specifically the science driver, the idea of a science driver, that, for that to happen, that was, you know, that was really what was the main target. Because that's what Kennedy represented, that legacy of Roosevelt and of the American system, really. So instead, you have Johnson that comes in, and again, he pours something like tens of billions of dollars into this war. A massive amount of money, right? Also, a massive amount of soldiers, though, not to mention there was like 500,000 men that got sent to their deaths in that war. But all along, the continued collapse of the infrastructure of the United States was also in process. Transport systems, electric power installations, water supplies, everything concerning public infrastructure was beginning to disintegrate. Because now we're talking about mid-60s, and nothing had been upgraded since the period leading up to before World War II, around Roosevelt's time, because of this policy. this policy employed by these new guys in charge. So there are some things to consider about this period, because you also have the takeover of the IMF, right? Don't forget about that. The IMF today, what is it? It's one of the biggest looting operations of the Third World. This is actually what got me interested in this movement originally, because I was studying in college, and when I learned in history class about the IMF, I just woke up, and I started doing a bunch of research on the IMF, World Bank, and WTO. And eventually, when I bumped into these guys, it all started to make a lot more sense. But yeah, I mean, the IMF originally wasn't corrupt. It wasn't aimed at being a corrupt. It was actually part of the Bretton Woods under Roosevelt. They had initiated these types of institutions for the purpose of lending interest to countries that needed it so that they could rebuild. But now, if you know anything about the IMF, I mean, they seduce you into taking a loan that you can never repay. All the third world countries are indebted beyond belief. Every year the debt increases to an amount that they can never get out of. So it's a real looting operation.
I think the only country to pay back such a loan is South Korea.
Okay.
All
right.
Canada paid back the
loan. The only civilization that.
Yeah, but I mean, you got to think, like, what are the? I mean, it's just insane, the way that they, because it's not just about the loan. It's about everything that you have to do in order to get the loan that you need. You need this loan. You know, if you don't take this loan, you're not going to make it, buddy. See, you have to take this loan. And if you take this loan because we have to lend you all this money, oh, you know, we're doing you a big favor. You have to do certain things, like devalue your currency, specialize in only an area of production, all kinds of restrictions that just choke your economy and your people. Like, it's a...
The partnership, the Europe
Okay, so you have a lot of these institutions, you have NGOs and all kinds of things like that.
Can you say how was the IMF taken over, or when did that happen?
No. I don't know the exact years, you know. There's a process of corruption that you see happen ever since Roosevelt's removal.
Just quick, there are old articles we published on how a bit of the story of the IMF in New Britain was.
Oh, yeah?
And why since the beginning it was hard to keep it good. So, and in the 70s there's a big shift, but there, I can find those articles. B-R-E-T-T-O-N, qui Woods, comme le bois.
Okay.
Une ville en
Okay, so this is, you know, this is the direction of things. There are a lot of okay, well, one thing also that's important about this process is this this attraction to money. And so companies began to move outside of their country, outside of the United States, right, to go and open up abroad because it was cheaper. Cheap labor, and making profits that way. But the problem is that the skilled labor force started to leave the United States, and you had a total loss in productive jobs, in the amount of available productive jobs. So it caused a major war, really, within the population. You had blue-collar workforce that were now fighting the white-collar service jobs for jobs. They were fighting each other. And it became like a class war where they began to hate each other. So
you saying that it came about because they were competing within jobs?
Yeah, there are different things. I mean, you have to consider also the movement of young baby boomers, the 68ers, that decided to rebel against industrial development because of the whole hippie green movement that targeted industries as being bad. And different social factors shapes the process also. But that's something that occurred, is that you had this idea forming within the population that industrial development was bad, it was dirty. Now, we don't have any, we're just going to move to the business sector, become brokers, or retail, real estate agents.
Yeah, and when you talk to people, they say they sort of put that idea forward as if, yeah, that's a higher level, service level, right? People say, yeah, well, we're evolving to a higher level of economy where we don't need to do the industrial jobs. We're now at a higher level, which is service.
Right? You use the mind.
Yeah, right.
You don't use the hand.
Yeah.
And now even our service jobs are leaving. So, we're even moving to a higher level where you just sit there and meditate. You do the job in your mind.
Push aside all the slave labor that's supporting you.
Right. So, this is another part of the process. So, in the late 60s, mid-60s, the economy of Britain began a recession. And for similar reasons, if you look at their investment, was also very much directed in the financial speculation, this type of ordeal, and the neglect in the physical economy brought about a collapse of the economy in Britain in about 66, 67. So at this point, because Britain was the second pillar of the Bretton Woods, they had tried to borrow money from the IMF. They had tried, they were for a long time trying to hide their collapse, but anyways, the point is that they were collapsing in the mid-60s to the point where the economic advisor to Charles de Gaulle, the president of France at the time, went to Britain and said, look, your currency is collapsing. your currency is inflated. You have to devalue your currency. The U.S. should do it too. You go, both of you are just, this is one of the greatest scandals in history. So there was this pressure on Britain to devalue its currency. Because the value of the currency, what they were saying their currency was worth, was way more than it actually was. Because they had nothing to show for anymore. They weren't even investing in their own economy to the point where it was collapsing. Right, so this opened the door for people like Jacques Rueff and Charles de Gaulle to come in and say, listen, this process is totally insane. you have to devalue, or we're going to pull out our investments from within your country. So give us all of our sterling, all of our silver in exchange for your British pounds. We don't want them anymore. They're worth nothing. And you, America, give us all of our gold for your U.S. dollars. We don't want them. They're worth nothing. So this was occurring in 67. They actually, de Gaulle demanded that the U.S. devalue its dollar by 100% against gold. That's how inflated it was. Against gold.
So it would be worth no ounces now?
Yeah. Like, it was worthless. It was really worth, look how much they've been printing for the Vietnam War. they had collapsed. This was a total joke. So, obviously,
they printed money to afford the war?
Yeah. Tens of billions of dollars.
Why? Don't they see? No?
Well, the Vietnam War is going to be another discussion,
yeah.
But you can look at how this was a total operation to bring about just this exactly this process, the total collapse of the value of the U.S. dollar to the point where nations would themselves demand the final destruction of the Bretton Woods. Big time. So,
so England was a pillar, and what other countries?
The U.S. Britain and the U.S.,
India?
Yeah.
Of Bretton Woods.
Yeah. So this is, okay, so obviously when Washington and Britain refused to do that, to devalue, because it meant collapsing their currencies to what it was actually worth.
People demanded their silver and gold.
Yeah, exactly. It started with France, and other nations followed. It started with pulling out of the gold pool. I said, all right, well, we're not going to hang in here to get screwed by this process anymore. So see you later, and give us all of our gold and silver back, even though it's worth about half the amount that it even though you should be giving me double the gold and double the silver, you know, whatever, we're going to get out now before it collapses even more, you know, it's just we keep losing more and more, you know what I mean? Like, the amount of gold that should have been given to France was about double what it
could actually get, or nominally could get.
Yeah. And so the longer it waited, the longer they realized that, man, if I wait another few years, I could be getting gold that's worth about a third of what I should be getting, and then worth about a quarter. So I'm just going to get out now while it's half. Yeah, and the dollar's doing that. So, you know, they saw that this was a losing process. They were walking down the... Yeah, exactly. And they pulled right out. And then it's like, you know, one nation has the guts to do it and others followed. So that, I missed a point here. What really led to their move to do that, their guts to do that, was Britain. Britain actually took the first step on this. Rather than remain strong with the U.S. and say, no, you know, we're the big guys, too bad, we're not doing this, Britain caved in and said, okay, you know, we'll devalue. So they devalued by 14%, and that gave the strength to all these other nations. It gave them the guts to go up against the United States and say, hey, you know, you're not the big dog anymore. Look, Britain went down, you're going down. So really this is important. It's important point that Britain decided that they knew if they stuck strong with the U.S. that it would be harder for these other nations to get them to devalue, to get the U.S. to devalue. It's really what they wanted was the U.S. to devalue. But because Britain, you know, they knew that, they said, okay, well, we'll devalue. And so all the pressure immediately went right on to the United States. That's what's called the sterling crisis, by the way, of 1968.
The devaluation of the pound and then...
And then pressure like hell on the dollar to devalue. So...
So at that point, is that the same as taking, as Britain taking their currency off of the sterling reserve system?
No. They didn't do, no. This is just a devaluation. Well, it was the U.S. that did that. That began that process. But this was just a devaluation. It wasn't really an official end of that financial architecture.
How do you devalue what's involved in that?
How do you devalue?
Yeah.
It's just the decision of the government.
Yeah.
They decided with that money you can buy that.
Yeah, instead of like a dollar, a British pound per, I don't know how much it was, but in U.S. per and gold, an idea of U.S., like just so that you can have an idea of it, would be like instead of saying it's $35 per fine ounce, you'd be like,
$60.
No. Lower.
No.
Yeah.
Okay, so the gold is less. It's worth less.
No. More money per ounce. More money per ounce.
Yeah.
$40.
More money per ounce.
$50. Oh, right. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Dollars per ounce.
Yeah.
Yeah, instead of like $35 per ounce, it would be more expensive. Right.
Yeah.
It would be like a 14% increase in.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Sorry. Yeah. So, so what Britain and France were, what France was saying then would be instead of $35 per fine ounce, 100% increase in that would be $70 per fine ounce. So it's a 100% devaluation would be like $70 per fine ounce. Okay. All right. So that was, keep that process in mind, because right now, I just want to take a look at some of the early forecasts that were made. And in the autumn of 1956, LaRouche had forecasted the imminence of a major U.S. economic recession, which was triggered by a credit bubble that he had spotted in the automobile and housing sector. But the, I mean, you guys remember that in 56, the U.S. entered the first major depression since the Great Depression before the Second World War. So that was the first forecast that LaRouche made. It was a short-term forecast, but nonetheless, it was pretty bang on. Then, during 1959 about the period between 1959 to 1960, LaRouche made his first long-term forecast, and what he said was that by the middle of the 1960s, the world was going to see a series of major monetary disturbances, which would eventually lead to the collapse of the existing Bretton Woods system, and then finally end in total increased looting of the Third World. He also said that this would eventually lead to fascist austerity measures modeled upon the fascist regimes that were employed in the early 20th century in Germany and in Italy, and that the world would soon see that be imposed on Europe, all parts of the world, but especially within the domestic economy of the United States. So that was in the late 50s. We just went through the 60s, and it's very clear that the series of monetary disturbances were, you know, very present. Yeah. So let's look at the 70s. You could say that the Bretton Woods, the collapse of Bretton Woods, had already occurred, like the Roosevelt's Bretton Woods system had already occurred, but the official collapse occurred. The official
dismantling
thanks, occurred in 1971. And this was at a time where U.S. official gold reserves represented less than one quarter of their official liabilities. Just as an interesting fact or whatever.
That was the Southeast Asian War that did that, yeah?
I think it was the entire process. You know, you also, look, you had many things. It was a gold reserve system, but it was, currencies were pegged to the U.S. dollar. So the U.S. dollar was the dominant currency internationally. The entire oil trade was done in dollars. You had the what was called the Euro-dollar market, which was when all of these dollars fled the United States. The entire world was, you know, swimming in U.S. currency. So it was a process of all of these things, really. But okay, So in 71, Nixon, President of the United States, comes in, and he gives a big fuck you to the whole world, which is demanding the devaluation. He says, too bad, pretty well. And instead, what we're going to do is screw the whole gold reserve system. You want your gold? Well, guess what? You can't get it now with U.S. dollars. It's not, you know, U.S. dollars are not backed by gold anymore. Yeah. What the hell? Like, everyone was shocked. You know? By, well, the invisible hand, my friend. Yeah, the invisible hand. The invisible hand in your pocket, grabbing the money in your pocket. But no, it was supply and demand, the market. That the demand would now be the decider of the value of the currency. So there's still a problem involved in that, because the demand for U.S. dollars had collapsed. Nobody wanted them anymore. They weren't worth anything. So the challenge at this point was, how do you create a demand for U.S. dollars?
What is that called? Spot trading?
Well, that comes later. But yeah, right. So, simultaneously, I guess. So look, this is at the same time as we're talking about the real final end of Roosevelt's Bretton Woods system, you're also looking at the reintroduction of the same policies that were employed throughout the 20s that led to the financial collapse in 1929, which is massive deregulation of the banking system, of financial operations. So no government intervention in how much the banks were issuing. Banks could issue as much money as they want. And a real accent on speculation, that this was the new market. So really what we're looking at is that the whole world being turned into a giant casino. So, okay. So what takes place at? I just want to mention one interesting thing, which is, it's just an interesting... Right. There was a meeting in 1973, which was a reunion of about 84 of the world's top banking financiers and oil men, policymakers. They're known as the Bilderberg Group. And these guys, they met in Saltsjöbaden, Sweden. So that was significant because, I just think it's interesting because Kissinger was one of the people that had attended that meeting. We know Kissinger's role at this time. He was the Secretary of State and the White House National Security Advisor to Nixon. So he's very present in U.S. politics at the time. And it's just, he attends this meeting of some of the most powerful businessmen in the world, all sitting on top of the oil cartels and banking system. And not even a few months after that meeting, he plays a crucial role in the orchestration of the Yom Kippur War, which was in Israel. Okay? Now, this war is significant because it led to the massive increase in oil prices by OPEC in the early 70s. So, look, I'm not going to go through all the details of the war, but Kissinger, Kissinger was a... If anyone's ever seen Othello, existing, where the way that he acts with the handkerchief, you know, that type of sophistry was employed by Kissinger to manipulate both sides of the argument. Both Israel telling them that Egypt and, because see, what happened was Egypt and Syria invaded Israel, demanding the territory back that they had taken from Palestine in the 60s. And so Kissinger was organizing, was talking to both sides. Well, he was saying to the Egyptians that Israel was weak at the time, and that if they wanted to do what they wanted, that they, that this was the best opportunity. Same time they were telling Israel, he was telling Israel that they weren't going to do it. But anyways, the details of that is not what's important. What's important is that this war is organized somehow. It takes place, and it leads to all the OPEC countries, oil exporting countries of the Middle East, to say, screw all the countries backing Israel. We set an oil embargo on you, and anyone that wants oil now has to pay the price that we're going to set until you stop backing Israel, until Israel gives back the land. And we are increasing the price by 400%. Yeah, well, and I mean, who pockets the cash? But these same oil conglomerates that were sitting on top of the Anglo-American oil cartels, because, and the Anglo-American banking system. Because where are all the profits going to go? They're not just going to sit in a Saudi royal house, you know, but they go into these major big banks. Yeah. Because
you know?
Because you place your money somewhere.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, we've done a bit of work on this period of how these, you know, how the relationship between America and Saudi Arabia over oil developed in the early 70s, and how they became the best of friends during the time of this oil crisis. Profits on both sides, man. Meanwhile, who's getting screwed the most?
Population.
Yeah, and also population of the nations that are the poorest. That can't afford, those that could barely afford that oil for electricity purposes beforehand could definitely not afford it right now. So you had really a total debauchery, especially of the third world.
So that was made possible by the fact that there was a monopoly on oil, Jenny?
Yeah, there was.
They could just say, okay, boys, tomorrow?
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's no competition, there's no regulatory aspect, there's no...
Well, the competition is taken out. There's good examples of that. Anyone that stood up to this in smaller countries, Italy, Mexico.
Like flying their own
oil. Yeah. And trying. Huh?
Most recent examples.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know so much about that, but yeah. I mean, these types of examples, the Shah of there are good examples, like the Shah of Iran, Mossadegh before that, Enrico Mattei of Italy, there's examples in South America of people that try to develop themselves and not get so involved in this, you know, this monopoly, this power that was being exerted on them, tried to develop themselves. They were and they were taken out for it. So, but the point, you know, that I'm making is that this eventually led to the looting of the third world. And so, just in going through some of the last bits of this, you really see how LaRouche's forecast was very accurate, and it was given about 10 years beforehand. 59.
Does he explain on what basis he makes forecasts?
Yeah, well, that's what I want to get into a little bit right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to go through the rest of his forecasts. There's a lot that happens also throughout the rest of the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s that lead to the disintegration that we're seeing today. But really, all of these events that occur after this point are just they're just an extension of the crisis which already existed at the time prior to the Sterling crisis, where at the time prior to the British devaluation.
That's what I don't understand. What had occurred between Roosevelt's death and those crises, like the Depression of the 1957 Depression, what occurred there to set in process a new dynamic which changed everything?
Well, instead of think about the fight you need actually to sustain a Roosevelt dynamic. Because Roosevelt is your causes who is doing deals with the Republicans. You want to have a bipartisan approach. So you're not like super free, but your dynamics is dominating. The problem is that when Roosevelt died, the same problematic dynamic is still around. You just find itself more space, more leeway.
So it's about an intention. Here.
Well, I think we should. I think we should keep going because this is the thing, right? How do you answer that question? Because that's really the point. You know, LaRouche. How does LaRouche make his forecast? It's easy to kind of see what happened after it happened, like you were saying last time. But how do you forecast something like that 10 years before it happening and have it come out so accurately like that? Okay. So because we want to now shift the discussion over to the ideas, right, to the question that you're posing, I'm going to skip the singularities, if you will, that occurred throughout the late 70s, 80s, and 90s that only just led to the further collapse of the system, which we're now seeing today, seeing that unfold today. You can look into some of that stuff yourself, you know, the policies that were enacted by Volcker, the high interest rates that were jacked up in the 80s, this policy of what they called controlled disintegration, these types of things, how this led to the blowout of the blowout of the savings and loans, and different speculative bubbles. But for now, I think we've been through enough detail, right? So I don't want to bore you to death with detail. But that's actually the point. What is it that we've just been looking at? Because when you're trying to understand this stuff, trying to understand what's happening today, you're looking at these events like we've just looked at them. Could you say that any one of these events, or maybe the combination of all of these events, is what's leading to the collapse of the crisis?
Events as such do not. There are specific intentions behind it.
Right, it's like it's like trying to understand the orbit by adding all of the positions, all of the individual positions, and saying that the orbit is because the planet is at every one of those individual positions.
The more observations, the more perfect the orbit.
You know, it's like, could you know why the orbit is by simply adding up all of the positions on the orbit? Or are all the individual positions on the orbit added up together the cause of that orbit? So then all of the detail and all of the facts and information that we've just been going through, of all of that, how do you know what to look at in order to understand and to arrive at an understanding of the causes of all of these different things? So think back to this method, the difference in method posed at the beginning between dynamics and statistics. Right, where he says, what did he say? Should read that.
The point to be made is not that I have been right in these matters, where presumed rival authorities and sundry commentators have been consistently wrong. The crucial point to be considered is the fact that my work has been premised on a correct principle of science, where my putative rivals have relied upon scientifically incompetent premises. The issue thus posed is that of dynamics, as opposed to the incompetence of the systems of mechanistic statistical extrapolation on which the empiricist and positivist number mechanics rely.
Yeah. Okay, so let's put aside for now the statistical mechanical analysis, because obviously that hasn't done us any good if that's the method employed by modern day economists. So what we want to know is the dynamics part.
You can see that the stress on that type of learning in university.
Yeah, you can.
Statistics is a whole year-long course.
Yeah, man.
Statistics to back it up.
Yeah.
It's kind of obvious.
Oh, you don't have statistics.
Yeah, you bring in that. Table.
I just run my computer all night while I'm sleeping, man.
Okay. But then, so what is dynamics? Right. The term originates from the ancient Pythagoreans' study of spherics. And spherics, spherics is, LaRouche said in a, where did he say it? God, I don't know, but I wrote it down when I read it. But anyways, what he says is that spherics underlies those actions. Spherics is what underlies those actions which violate the perception of a simply spherical universality. Forget the title spherics for now. Just listen to the question. This is a question that you want to think about. What underlies those actions which violate the perception of a simply spherical universality?
What's a spherical universality?
Well, the spherical universality... Huh? Well, okay. I mean... Well, what you want to think of is this comes from the ancient Pythagoreans, who had gained some of their insight from the ancient Egyptians, who were known for studying astronomy and astronavigation. So what you would call spherical, I guess, or your original idea of a simply spherical universality would be when you look up at the sky every night, what you see is this motion which comes in a... I mean, you could look at it in the day. You see the moon and the sun go around, and it looks as though the universe is a sphere. You've got a sphere around you. But then what happens when, over the course of a certain period of time, when you're observing a wandering, a rebellious planet, which is disobeying this motion, maybe it's doing its own circular thing. But you come to realize that it's not. Because after its cycle, it doesn't come back to the very same place in the orbit. There's a little inequality. It's a little bit off. So there's a violation of your assumption of a simply spherical universe.
Okay. One could say that the statistical measures are based on the assumption that the universe is spherical, because then you could extrapolate exactly and it would work, but it doesn't.
Well, use the astronomy as an example.
Yeah. I'm just using this principle and...
I get what you're saying. Yeah, because what spherics would look at, which is something that they don't understand, is what is it which is underlying that action,
yeah,
which is violating your perception,
yeah,
of a simply spherical universe.
Yeah.
Right? So you notice that it's not spherical, so what is the actual action which is causing it to be not perfectly spherical? Well, you want to look at what function or what principle is that non-simply spherical action a reflection of? Right? Because... I'll just in order here, but because when you, I mean, I'll just mention, like, well, no, let's leave it. Okay. So you want to look at the just keep this in mind. So when you're noticing these singularities, you're using them, say, as a starting point for your investigation. And then the singularity is because they're a moment that reflects something maybe unusual, or they signify change, something that stands out, right? So you'll use these as a starting point within all the chaos of the stars above to start your investigation. And then when you realize that there's an inequality there, then you want to question, well, what is the action which is underlying that process, or what is the principle causing it to act in this way, of which that action is a reflection? What is the principle which that inequality is reflecting? Because you're never actually going to see like when you think of the gravitation, you never actually Kepler discovers that there's a principle of gravity which is moving the planets on a very specific orbit at very specific specifically that they're altering speeds and they're on a very specific orbit, and he recognized that it's a principle that's causing this motion. But you never actually see the principle. So...
You can't touch.
No. No. But the question that's asked by someone like Kepler, a scientist, would be... not really to describe that motion, that inequality that you see, but to ask, what is what you're seeing a reflection of? Because it is not gravity itself.
That's not empirically available.
Yeah. Okay. So you want to ask that question. So what is the principle which is shaping the domain of action? Okay. Then what is a principle first? Right. How can you begin to think about principle? So just as an example, I mean, working through the new astronomy is the best example, but but we just did that all in one night. So, so here's another example. Okay, do we have? Okay, I wish I had. Yeah. Okay. Let's take also. okay, flat plane, right? On a flat plane, from A to B, what is the least action pathway?
Straight line.
Okay. Straight line. I need to look at a lot of things, you know. Here. Yeah, this is good. On this water bottle, from A to B, what's the least action pathway?
On the surface or through the...
On the surface.
Curved?
Yeah. Maybe it would be somewhere like this, but maybe it would be a little bit higher, like that. But it's not the same curvature as on a flat plane. On a sphere, from A to B, what's the least action pathway? It's curved. Yeah.
But it's not necessarily, like, it's curved because it's in the sphere, but also, you don't just trace it from one point to the other. There's a, because I just remember a plane, when you took the plane, they showed the trajectory of the plane.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's like a, because if you look from far off, you could say, okay, well, it's kind of straight. It doesn't look that curved, you know. It's actually that it goes up, and as you were seeing on the bottle, it doesn't just go curved like that, but also there's, you know, like
oh, cool.
Two curves,
yeah, cool.
Two curvatures, like this one.
On a sphere, that is?
Well, on the surface of the globe. Yeah. The plane, then when they show the trajectory in the,
yeah,
in the plane, yeah, you see the plane going east.
Yeah, like for instance, if you fly from New York to Korea, you fly through Alaska.
Yeah. And then, okay, so another example. You can have another example moving, say, on a torus, right? From these two points right here, the least action pathway would be a curve that way. But, you know, if you had these two points right here, then the least action pathway would be going along this way.
Can you say that it would be
this is a little bit of a different case.
Alongside the physical surface of that plane.
Yeah. alongside the physical surface. You know, I'm actually just using an I'm just trying to find an example to get at the way a change in principle from flat plane, say, to sphere, you have a change in the curvature, in the least action pathway. So the action, the principle is acting to shape the domain of action. A change in principle changes the domain of action, or the changes the curvature of the least action pathway. This is an example. I'm just using an example of shapes. But you can think of it in that way, though, of how a principle has the power to do that. Okay. So then you want to ask, what is the underlying principle, or lack of principle in our case, which is shaping the pathway of events in current history?
Can you repeat that?
Yeah, what's the principle which is shaping the domain of action, or the curvature of events in current history, what we just went through? Yeah. Yeah. Well, here's the funny thing, right? I don't know if that... Well, I mean, here's the funny thing, is that in this case, it seems more like a lack of principle in our case. But, just to get a better idea of this, think back to the beginning. The reason why I showed that was because the imagery really demonstrated how we just looked at a part of the New Deal, the mobilization to rebuild America, and how you had a real emphasis on a science driver program with technological innovation and all kinds of development that changed every sector of the economy. So, how did that change come about, though? I mean, was that just come to people in a dream, or was it beaten out of them by Roosevelt, who said, if you don't do this, we're gonna get taken over by the Nazis, and we need, how did people come up with the ideas?
How did he come up with the ideas?
No, I mean, just...
Why did people listen?
No, but just more what happened? Like, think of an example. You're looking for an example of principle so we can understand a bit more about what this is. How do you think of principle? If we're looking for what the principle is, which is shaping the curvature of the history that's been unfolding over the past few decades, we want to understand what that principle is, because we know that principles act to shape the domain of action in which things are operating. Then we want to know what principle is shaping the curvature of the last few decades. But we need to know what a principle is. So how do you start to think about principle?
One example could be people act according to what they believe is enhancing the quality of life the best. So if they act according to that, it would be worth it to investigate what kind of beliefs they have about what the good life would be. And then you can use that as data for forecasting what they will probably do in a specific context.
Yeah.
That would be, for me, a principle.
And even even one step further than that. If people are acting within the context of what makes their life better, it's also worth looking into what actually makes the life better.
Yeah.
Yeah, what actually like,
yeah.
Makes life better. Because if you're talking about what people feel and what they might do, then you're into human psychology and not really into the physical aspect of what actually is.
Well, I don't think it's separable. When you feel something, it tells you, there is something I want, and then you get, then you have to connect that to what can I specifically do in the physical realm, or how can I manipulate things to change the situation so that I feel better. You can't separate that.
But isn't it the same as the principle of survival? You just trying to survive.
Well, I don't think so much about survival all the time because that's pretty much settled most of the time. But when it's not, of course, then
people acted that way in the times of Roosevelt because they were
afraid they wouldn't survive or it would.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the crisis perseverance.
I think the what we're trying to investigate is because she was talking about the question of forecast. So if you get to the principle, because you could say maybe, like what we have right now, right? You have, if you compare the New Deal with, for example, the infrastructure projects under the PPP, right? You could say, well, it's a new deal in terms of numbers, in terms of people saying we need infrastructure. But what type of forecast would fall from these cities to the person? And what do you have to look at in order to be able to make the forecast?
Mm-hmm.
So why does LaRouche say, that Schwarzenegger and Bloomberg is flying their ass off? Well, how do I know, like the example I use, how do I know if Louis Michel is really well-intentioned when he talks about Africa? Because in terms of the approach, you can say, okay, I'm kind of nice. But I think the TPP New Deal forces you to get that. LaRouche, he got to something deep into, let's say, the TPP people, saying, okay, this is worse than the plague.
One thing about the forecast by most of like all of the forecasts by the Russians that the forecast will collapse.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. we should get to that.
Kind of depressing.
Should change the tune.
The one in the 54 is also about a collapse and of the Bretton Woods.
Yeah. So this is that's true. Now that's why I didn't go through all of them because really. They're all just an extension, really, of the same one. Okay, so here's the thing. Before I get into that more fully, on this question of principle, because that's what you've got to be able to tune your eyes to. You've got to sharpen your ability to pinpoint. To recognize what is a principle, which has the ability to shape the world around it. So, think of the example of a new discovery, because what you're saying is true. What you guys are getting at is that this is something that mankind's been doing. In fact, the best example is looking at the history of mankind and how we've developed. How is it that we've been able to increase the population like this? Because if it weren't for these new discoveries, we would have had collapses in population level over and over again. Right? Be it the first ideas to sharpen tools for hunting, or the idea of the wheel for transportation. Or you could come to something more modern like electricity. Man, imagine the world without electricity. We wouldn't be able to survive. at least not this level of population. So you look at how this new discovery has the power to shape the entire world around it and change the entire and shape the domain of action. That's the best way that I think about it. If the principle, for example, I mean, you could use these as examples to help you think about how that principle makes it so that the least action pathway is something that's very specific. If you change the principle, then you change the least action pathway. You change the shape, I mean, you change the least action pathway. As an example, you could look at the introduction of new, or the discovery of new ways of providing energy, like moving from coal to oil, and how that leap introduces a whole new ability of action in your economy. Or then from looking at the introduction of nuclear power and the new potential for action now brought in with the introduction of discovery of nuclear power. So a discovery of principle.
In that case, does it mean that creative energy is not a good thing for the oligarchy? Are you?
The oligarchy and the village and the controllers?
Yeah, but I mean like for that whole thing that we call the economy.
Why? Free energy?
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
If it will replace all those big valuable things like oil and would it be a threat for the economy?
Well, look, I mean, I didn't go through any of this, but another one of these details, rather, it's better to look at it like that, because none of these events really are, well, anyways, the point, all I was going to say was that something that we saw very much in the 70s, and also is very present today, is an attack on nuclear energy. And originally, largely, it was financed by these same oil cartels. Sure, man, they knew that nuclear power was going to turn the eyes of the world towards nuclear energy because it allowed for so much more. You know, it was cheaper compared to the amount of energy that it gave out than oil. So, I mean, these guys, they did everything to slander nuclear power to, you know, we can go into that some other time, but orchestrate different events like Three Mile Island, you know. So, yeah, sure. I mean, these guys are pretty vicious, you know. They don't want to lose that power that they've...
Mais ta question, enfin, c'est plus... Est-ce qu'il y a une énergie qui est gratuite, c'est ça?
Non, ça, c'est sûr qu'il y en a. Il y a beaucoup de... Parce que là, elle parle de, tu vois, de des inventions qui améliorent le vie. Puis, par rapport à ça, dans le fond, ce que j'ai vu ces dernières années, c'est que beaucoup d'inventeurs ont mis sur pied des technologies qui ont rapport avec l'énergie gratuite. Et puis, toutes ces inventions-là sont tous... Il n'y a rien de ça qui fonctionne. Il n'y a rien de tout ça qui fonctionne. Et puis là, tout le monde se pose la question, pourquoi est-ce que les gens ne veulent pas investir dans de l'énergie gratuite? Et puis là, moi, je me demandais, par rapport à tout ce que tu dis, est-ce que l'énergie gratuite, dans le fond, c'est
Oui, une menace, c'est ça, pour toute économie et toute forme de toute économie de n'importe quel pays, parce que dans le fond, si l'énergie est convertie en argent, dans le fond, c'est ça que je comprends. L'énergie ou tout ce qu'on peut extraire de n'importe où sur la Terre, si ça peut être converti en argent. Puis, donc, le process, c'est à partir de ce process-là que le gouvernement peut pouvoir investir au bon endroit pour pouvoir augmenter son économie, ou ainsi de suite. Mais s'il investit dans quelque chose que, dans le fond, une fois qu'on parle de l'énergie gratuite, si on investit dans ça, il n'y aura pas de retombées économiques.
This idea that, like, do you need a link? Because what he's identifying is if you have an energy which is free, so therefore there's no money assigned to it, it's free. So imagine you have like fusion, it just gets very, very cheap.
Yeah.
In the long term.
I think it's more, I would suggest that if you get to a point where energy is free or almost free, rather than being a cause for economic collapse, it's actually an indication that your economy is very healthy.
But the moon may be the energy which remains, and that's what you do with that.
Not only that, but in order to get to that point, one of the things that happens with manufacturing, for instance, is that the first thing you make is very expensive. But then with technological process, progress, and new machinery and better ideas, all of a sudden you're making many of that product for very cheap. Things get cheaper as your economy gets better. Yeah. And so, I mean, that's one idea too with labor, where to take your industrial capacity and go to a cheap country, everybody says that, oh, the labor's cheaper, so you're getting the product for cheaper. But it, in real terms, per product, there's a good argument to say that it's more expensive. It's actually more expensive in terms of how to make it, you know, person hours, let's say. If you're using 10 people for the place of one machine, you actually cost a lot more in time to those people. In a healthy economy, your objective is to get people to have free time.
It's a threat only for people, because if you have more energy and you have you can see you have a bigger human potential.
Mm-hmm.
If, for example, if South Africa develops and starts selling his types of nuclear power plant and gives, like LaRouche was saying, if you develop, let's say, Zimbabwe and Sudan, so the agricultural power, you can have a food for the whole world, you can produce for the whole world. You know? So energy will give a potential for your population. That's what people will fear. Like fusion energy is a good example of a victim, because we should already have nuclear fusion if we had kept on the same pace.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and thing, especially with something like energy, in order to go from fission to fusion, you have to have, you know, very creative minds working on it.
Yeah.
And the money to do it.
Yeah, that's the point that we want to emphasize, I think.
And that's also, you know, that's the cost, which makes it more expensive when you make cheap stuff with cheap people.
Mind does not get developed.
What you're losing is not a money thing, but a human potential.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You have millions of people being acting like slaves or schmoes, taking a beer at night, watching TV, losing genius.
And people, people who believe that without the money in energy, if energy gets too cheap, what are we going to do? I think it's because they're doing exactly what we're kind of pointing out tonight, which is thinking about money as economy, which it isn't.
Yeah, you think of the way that the maglev train would it's, you don't want to think of it in the way that it's going to collapse government revenue, and so government will have less to invest in the economy. You want to look at the potential that it introduces to the development of your population. You heard about the idea of the maglev train? The maglev train, right? We're going to connect Canada with Russia and Asia through the Bering Strait. And it's going to have a link that moves throughout the whole world, really. But you think of the way that, okay, so a government, a project like that, billions of dollars that the government had to issue as credit. Whoa. So, you know, maybe at first the train to use would be more expensive to pay back the cost of the train. Over the long run, though, the only cost you need, the only revenue you need is maintaining the capital, maintaining the capital investment needed on the train. But, so you don't want to look at a free train as bringing in zero government revenue, and so, man, why would we do that? The government's going to have is going to make no money off that train, so they're not going to have a source of income that they can use to invest in other areas of the economy. What you want to look at is the potential that it presents within your population to then accomplish more. But okay, so this discussion on discovery of principle of new technologies and this type of scientific progress, Lynn says, think of these discoveries of principle as having an effect comparable to what might be considered as mankind's virtual evolution into a higher species through scientific progress.
That's a quote.
Yeah. It's kind of like a leap in your...
Can you
use
that again?
Yeah, sure. Huh? I mean, I think there's some humor involved.
Yeah.
I mean, but he says, think of these discoveries of principle as having an effect comparable to what might be considered as mankind's virtual evolution into higher species through scientific progress. Now, in a different discussion, he says this. Think of what we see literally or hear literally. Sorry, I read that wrong. Start over. What we think we see literally or hear literally is not the merely apparent, not the actual form of that whose existence our sense organs report to our brains. So this is the beginning. This is really the beginning here of the difference in method. How do you investigate? How do you think about finding principle, the principle which is causing the action to unfold in a certain way? What we think we see literally or hear literally is not the merely apparent, not the actual form of that whose existence our sense organs report to our brains. So...
Yeah, but that's
not the actual form of the thing which...
What we think we're seeing, what we actually see unfolding in the sky, what we see clearly, empirically, the retrograde motion, is as our senses report that to our minds, is not the actual principle itself. the inequality that we see after a Mars year when it returns to the same place in the orbit, but it's not the exact same place. It's a few degrees off, that inequality. But we see what we can perceive that with our senses. That's not the actual principle. It doesn't have to be that inequality. You can take just Mars's orbit or any orbit. What you're looking at, what you think you're seeing, is not the actual cause of what you see, but merely a reflection of the principle, which is causing that, which is generating that.
How much you hear is also it's just the sound waves that you hear. You don't hear the meaning.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah. The idea, when I'm talking to you, is not within every word. You're not just going to break down every word that I say and find what it is that I'm saying in every one of in that word. But you have to wait till the sentence is over, or till the class is over.
I get it. But
okay. So gravity, or that's a good example also, that the idea is presented in the whole of the piece, not in the breakdown of every individual note. Or retrograde motion is not gravity itself, but merely a reflection of the principle. Yeah, I mean, I don't have to pick retrogradation. That's a little bit different. That occurs because of what we see from Earth. But, I mean, you could pick the revolution of the ecliptic every night. But that's not right. But what Kepler does, as we've said, we touched on earlier, is he uses these singularities. Because he doesn't know the principle. And that's the difference, right? This is the major difference between all the other astronomers who merely said, well, my model is going to be this. I'm going to paste the model that's going to describe everything that I see. What Kepler said was, well, that's easy to do. I want to know why. What's causing it to unfold in this particular way? What's the cause of that inequality that I'm noticing? Mars doesn't come back to the same place in the sky. Why is that? But you don't know the cause right away. So what he does is he uses the singularity, the reflection, and investigates it to come to know something about the cause which is generating it. Or as Bruce likes to say, using the shadows to come to know something about the principle of which the shadow is a reflection. Okay, so we're almost done. How you guys getting tired? Staying late, eh? It's 11. Okay. But that's really, look, if we've gotten that far, that's good. Just to bring it back to then this process that we're trying to understand, with the history of the last few decades, when you're looking at all of these events and these details, none of these events are in of themselves the cause of the collapse. They might have been real big events. You could say the the takedown of Bretton Woods is what is what led to this economic crisis. But really, that event is not really the the cause of the collapse itself, in the same way that the orbit is not generated by the sum of all the individual positions of the planet on the orbit, but it's generated in that specific way by this principle of gravitation. So,
nor is the present financial collapse caused by the collapse of Bear Stearns.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Or is it caused by any of the facts and details that I went through at the beginning, only to just try to paint a picture to give you a better understanding of what's going on. But it is actually not the cause, really, of this crisis, but merely a reflection of the principle which was employed, or in our case, a principle which was forbidden, actually.
It would make sense now with the type of thinking that economists do to start saying that the economy is being collapsed by this collapse of Earth. Or if a crisis deepens, some people might say...
Yeah, because they don't...
Bear Stearns caused the American...
Disease. Yeah, sure, you could definitely hear that.
But the principle is really the wrong way of thinking.
Okay. So that's... Right, that's clear that that I used. See, none of these events are the cause of the collapse, but I used them because I noticed them as turning points, as singularities in history. I didn't know the cause, but I noticed the singularity, and by investigating these singularities, you could come to know something about the principle of which these singularities are a reflection. So, in our case, you could say that they are a reflection of, say, the principle of scientific progress and discovery of new technologies, as we've just discussed, would be a good example of a principle. But that rather they are the reflection of the neglection of that principle. So the principle of scientific progress, of discovery, of facilitating this type of innovative development in your population, that being neglected leads to the collapse of, well, originally what we saw in the mid-50s and then leading into the mid-60s. But since that time, that hasn't changed at all. But there's been no, there's been no turnaround saying, let's bring back Roosevelt's New Deal. Remember, when the economy collapsed in 57, the U.S. establishment, so-called, was brought in to deal with the collapse. What was it? It was a roundtable discussion of CFR, Council on Foreign Relations, and the Rockefeller Fund. These guys dealt with the 57 recession. So you're looking at an intention. Yeah. You're looking at a direct intention to forbid this type of the introduction or the... continuation of that principle Roosevelt had employed. On that basis, it becomes rather obvious where the whole thing is going. And you could say that it's going to keep going that way, so long as that's the policy.
So somebody decided.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Did they knew the cost for the general population, or did they calculate?
You're dealing with people that are pro-empire.
Okay, yeah. And so they know, they are aware of the cost, but they're taking it because they think it's the
pro-empire, that means you're, you don't care about people. You know, whatever happens, the cost of the population is not a concern to you. In fact, if it only leads to the decrease in population, eventually, then in the eyes of an imperialist, that's a good thing, because more people are more difficult to govern. Yeah. More difficult to govern more people. It's much easier to govern 1 billion people than it is to govern 8, 10 billion people.
Furthermore, human beings are just complicated animals anyway.
Okay, so rather than just analyze all the data, all the facts, all the details that we've went through, and try to understand them and from the standpoint of this data, then predict the next 6 months where the economy is going, what we're doing is searching for the principle, which is the cause of these events.
But Gauss predicted about the orbit of Ceres.
Yeah.
Did he predict that?
Apparently he did, yeah.
Or, so, as in that this is going to be the point where it will be.
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah.
If you know the you can point very precisely.
Okay, let's keep moving because it's getting late. There's not that much left. We don't have to go through. How tired is there? Are people like ready to
die?
Well, I mean, because I don't. We could just. Cause, okay. Well, anyways, the point is that eventually then what you're looking at, because an economy is never just one principle interacting, not merely the principle, like the scientific discovery. That's one example. You know, this would be an example if you've got one principle determining the curvature of least action. But in an economy, really, this is what Riemann outlined, is that it's what he calls a multiply connected manifold, many principles interacting. It's one of the most complex organisms. But what you need to think about if you're looking at economics in the way that LaRouche is once you understand how to pinpoint the principle that's interacting, or that's acting, then is to be able to look at the interaction of those principles together and how a change or introduction or removal of one principle changes the relationships among all the others. The good example that's simple for now is nuclear power, the introduction of a new technology like that, which changes the relationship of every sector of the economy. Mm-hmm. So then in that, you know, from that standpoint, it's really not the financial markets, but it's the physical economy which is real. And, you know, on that basis, just merely off that basis, all of these economists right now are wrong, because they're measuring economics off the wrong thing. They're looking at the wrong thing. Financial markets. Man. Yeah. Yeah, you're like last year of university economics major is bent on financial markets. Yeah. It's the study of financial markets in university today. Highest level economics.
It should be a psychology class.
I dropped out. Bore me to hell. Have you ever taken an econ class in university?
No.
Oh my god. I thought it was the most boringest thing ever. Originally, I wanted to study economics because I wanted to, I wanted to see how you could develop people, especially third world countries. But then you get to class and it's studying graphs after graph after graph, and I hated it. Anyway, okay. Right. Okay, so then, real quick, and we can get into this in a future class, just to give you a taste of what LaRouche is looking at. He's looking at, if you're looking at the physical economy then what you want to look at is the rate of increase and the physical standard of living. And that's going to determine the health of your economy. I mean, doesn't it just make so much sense? I mean, but anyways.
It does, but the idea of a rate of increase
is an added
dynamic.
Yeah, it is.
So it's not just that the
increase.
The economy is increasing, but it's
yeah.
How fast you can
yeah. Grow. And you know,
population.
Yeah, right. But also to consider that if your economy life standard of your people in your economy is increasing, and every year it is increasing, say like from year to year for the first five years, it's increasing 15%. But on the sixth year, it only increases 10%. And on the seventh year, it increases 5%. It's still increasing, but the rate at which it's increasing is collapsing. So it's indicating a problem at some point. Somewhere there's a problem. And for this, to measure this, LaRouche actually developed a concept called potential relative population density, which he developed in order to measure this. What's the rate of increase of the standard of living of people in your country, in your nation, in your economy? So you're looking at...
How many people could you support on the same piece of land?
Yeah, relative to... You got to consider the land itself, because some places are not as fertile as others. And relative to the current development of your people, right? Not everyone is as educated right now. Like third world countries right now, you've got to consider that the level of development of your culture is not
Like relative potential population density. The word potential in that means like. All things considered, you know, you might not have that population on that land, but it's how much land that could support with your technology and your industry at that given level. Relative population, potential relative population.
Well, take two opposite examples. It's a made up example, but if you have Canada and Saudi Arabia with the same level of technology, you could arrive at a different number of people you can sustain because Canada's land is in Saudi Arabia kind of sucks. But actually, so the number you can sustain is different, but probably the rate of increase might be the same, for example.
Okay, so that's what he's looking at. He's looking at what is the rate of increase of your potential relative population density. So, on this account, if you're going to look at the rate of increase of potential relative population density, Canada, the United States, and you can probably find other nations, but looking at the United States, which is a very important player in world economy. This has been collapsing. There's been a net physical decline since the 60s in the relative potential population density.